Anthony Weiner. So we'd rather look at this race and make sure that the best person really gets to office. We think she's the one that has the best chance of being a Democrat in City Hall that can work with working families.
What's the problem with Anthony Weiner being in the lead?
Anthony Weiner is just for Anthony Weiner. He's going to be held accountable to nobody. He will be Bloomberg number two because he's going to have the political independence from the unions, from everybody in public. And I find it really hard that somebody who dragged to the mud women into a scandal can be considered by New Yorkers to represent them in City Hall.
Another endorsement on the steps of City Hall came for mayoral hopeful John Liu from the Muslim communities throughout New York City. Linda Sarsour is with the Arab American Association of New York.
Based on some data that we have run in the voter system, the Muslim Democratic Club of New York has found that there are 105,000 registered Muslim voters in New York City. 70% of those registered voters are Democrats. We are an underestimated community. And we have troops on the ground for John Liu. We've done petitioning for John Liu, and we will continue to do petitioning until the deadline. Do not underestimate the Asian vote, the Muslim vote. We will come out strong for John Liu, and we will teach people a lesson that it's not about who has the highest number in the polls. It's about who has in their heart to go to the polls on September 10th to vote for John Liu. Right. And that's what's going to happen on September 10th. And we pray that it's just and a fair election and that John Liu becomes the next mayor of New York City.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Inshallah.
John Liu, very happy to have this endorsement.
This is very meaningful to me. The Muslim community is a community that I've been very close to over the years, particularly because they have faced some adversity and hardships unfairly and unnecessarily so. And I've been proud to stand by them on some of the issues that they care about and that I care about as a New Yorker and as an American. And on a more practical level, the Muslim community is a fast-growing community here in New York City that is fully engaged politically, and this will add a lot of wind to my sails.
Another rally for two bills of the Community Safety Act was held this afternoon at City Hall. The vote on the two bills, 1079, which would create an independent office of Inspector General, and 1080, which would widen profiling protections and provide an enforcement mechanism to make it easier for individuals to sue the department over street stops, which they feel reflect racial profiling. The bills are expected to pass since they only need a simple majority of 26 votes, but there is question as to whether one of the two bills, Intro 1080, will have enough votes down the road to get the 34 votes needed to override the expected veto by Mayor Bloomberg. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence, but committed no and bad mistakes.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 26, 2013. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Rebecca Miles, and Linda Perry. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and WBAI.org.
We are the champions, my friends.
Indeed. The time is 12 midnight. We have just heard a rebroadcast of the WBAI Evening News, and interesting it was tonight. Our next scheduled program will be Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Please stay tuned.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the world stop and listen, when will we all stop and see? Upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. Still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today, we celebrate the magnificent life of Nelson Mandela. At the present moment, our latest information is that Madiba, Nelson Mandela, is now under life support systems in his Pretoria hospital bed. Mandela's second successor as president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, has canceled a trip to Mozambique And the American president, Barack Obama, will apparently be denied a photo op when he arrives in South Africa Friday, because Mandela's family has declared the beloved leader to be, quote, indisposed, quote, as he battles a persistent lung infection under intensive care in Pretoria. As part of this Earthwatch tribute to Mandela, we shall hear Archbishop Desmond Tutu recalling highlights of his exchanges with Mandela, as well as the African National Congress leader himself, addressing a capacity crowd in Oakland, California, shortly after his release from 27 years of apartheid imprisonment. But we begin Earthwatch today with then-ANC Chair Nelson Mandela's historic address to the United Nations almost exactly 23 years ago in June 1990.
I now have the pleasure to invite Mr. Nelson Mandela, Deputy President of the ANC, to address the meeting.
Your Excellency, Ambassador Ibrahim Gambari, Permanent Representative of the Federal Republic of Nigeria and Chairman of the Special Committee Against Apartheid. Your Excellency, President of the General Assembly, Ambassador Joe Gerber. Your Excellency, Mr. Perez de Cuellar, Secretary General of the United Nations Organizations. Your Excellencies, Permanent Representatives, Heads of the Observer Missions, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, we feel especially honored and privileged to have the possibility today to stand at this particular place to speak to all of you who represent the peoples of the world. We are most grateful to you, Mr. Chairman, the Special Committee Against Apartheid, the Secretary General, and all the member states of the organization for making it possible for us to be here. The tragedy is that what has created the need for this gathering and made it seem natural that we must gather in this historic meeting place is the fact of the continuing commission of a crime against humanity. How much better it would have been if we were meeting to celebrate a victory in hand, a dream fulfilled, the triumph of justice over a tyrannical past, the realization of the vision enshrined in the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It will forever remain an indelible blight on human history that the apartheid crime ever occurred. Future generations will surely ask, what error was made that this system established itself in the wake of the adoption of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights? it will forever remain an accusation and a challenge to all men and women of conscience that it took as long as it has before all of us stood up to say, enough is enough. Future generations will surely inquire what error was made that this system established itself in the aftermath of the trials at Nuremberg. These questions will arise because when this august body, the United Nations, first discussed the South African question in 1946, it was discussing the issue of racism. They will be posed because the spur to the establishment of this organization was the determination of all humanity never again to permit racist theory and practice to dragoon the world into the deathly clutches of war and genocide. And yet, for all that, a racist tyranny established itself in our country. As they knew would happen, who refused to treat this matter as a quaint historical aberration? This tyranny has claimed its own conclave of victims. It has established its own brutal worth by the number of children it has killed and the orphans, the widows and widowers it can claim as its unique creation. And still it lives on, provoking strange and monstrous debates about the means that its victims are obliged to use to rid themselves of this intolerable scourge, eliciting arguments from those who choose not to act that to do nothing must be accepted as the very essence of civilized opposition to tyranny. We hold it as an inviolable principle that racism must be opposed by all the means that humanity has at its disposal. Wherever it occurs, it has the potential to result in a systematic and comprehensive denial of human rights to those who are discriminated against. This is because all racism is inherently a challenge to human rights because it denies the view that every human being is a person of equal worth with any other, because it treats entire peoples as subhuman. This is why it was correct to characterize the apartheid system as a crime against humanity, and appropriate that the international community should decide that it should be suppressed and punishment meted out against its perpetrators. We pay tribute to this organization and its member states for this and other decisions and actions it took to expunge this crime. Mr. Chairman, we also take this opportunity to salute the Special Committee Against Apartheid, which has been and is a very important instrument in our struggle against the iniquitous and oppressive policies of the South African government. We salute also the states that make up its membership, who have been unrelenting in their resolve to contribute everything they could to ensure that the world was mobilized to act against the apartheid system. In this connection also, sir, allow us to express a well-deserved tribute to your country, Nigeria, which you so ably represent, as did your predecessor in this important office, His Excellency, Major General Joseph Garba, current President of the General Assembly, and under whose leadership the United Nations Declaration on South Africa was adopted by consensus at the 16th special session of the General Assembly last December. That declaration will go down in history as one of the most important documents in the struggle of the international community against apartheid. The fact that it was adopted by consensus was itself a telling blow against the apartheid system and a vital statement underlying the unity of the world community on the South African question and its resolution. We look forward to the report that the distinguished Secretary General of the United Nations will submit dealing with the question of the implementation of the declaration in South Africa. This report will also be important to the extent that it will provide a basis for further decisions by the United Nations regarding future action on the question of apartheid. What must, however, be clear is that the apartheid system remains in place. None of the principles laid down in the declaration has been implemented to provide what the declaration characterized as an internationally acceptable solution of the South African question. Similarly, the profound and irreversible changes which the declaration visualized have not yet occurred. The conclusion from these observations would seem clear to us. It is that nothing which has happened in South Africa calls for a revision of the positions that this organization has taken in its struggle against apartheid. We therefore strongly urge that there should be no relaxation of existing measures. The sanctions that have been imposed by the United Nations and by individual governments should remain in place. We also urge that the United Nations should do everything in its power to maintain the unity it achieved when it adopted the Declaration on South Africa last December. We therefore hope that all member states will continue to act in concert so as not to create any situation in which those who are opposed to change in our country find encouragement to resist change. Because some countries would have destroyed the consensus that has been achieved. In this regard, we take this opportunity once more to call on the countries of the European Community, which are holding a summit meeting in a few days' time, themselves to remain faithful to the purposes of the declaration, to whose elaboration they were party and for which they voted. At the initiative of the ANC, the process has been begun, which could lead to a just political settlement in our country. At our well-known meeting in Cape Town at the beginning of last month, we agreed with the South African government on the removal of the obstacles to negotiations, which are identified in the declaration. The process of implementing that agreement has started. But as this distinguished gathering knows, a lot still remains to be done before we can say that a climate conducive to negotiations has been created. We therefore still have some distance to travel before we undertake the further steps outlined in the declaration, leading to negotiations for the adoption of a new democratic constitution. The fact that a good beginning was made in Cape Town should not lead us to conclude that further progress is assured or that we will not have to confront major obstacles in future. In this regard, we would like to reiterate what we have said before, that we believe that President de Klerk and his colleagues in the leadership of the ruling party are people of integrity. We are of the view that they will abide by decisions that are arrived at in the course of our discussions and negotiations. This in itself is an important victory of our common struggle, because it is that struggle which has made the cost of maintaining the apartheid system too high and helped to convince the ruling group in our country that changes can no longer be resisted. It is, however, also true that there are many amongst our white compatriots who are still committed to the maintenance of the evil system of white minority domination. Some are opposed because of their ideological adherence to racism. Others are resisting because they fear democratic majority rule. Some of these are armed and are to be found within the army and the police. Outside of these state agencies, other whites are working at a feverish race to establish paramilitary groups whose stated aim is the physical liquidation of the ANC. Its leadership and membership, as well as other persons or formations which these right-wing terrorists see as a threat to the continued existence of the system of white minority domination. We cannot not afford to underestimate the threat that these defenders of a brutal and continuing reality pose to the whole process of working towards a just political settlement. The ANC is determined to do everything in its power to ensure speedy movement forward towards the peaceful abolition of the apartheid system. To this end, we are engaged in many initiatives within South Africa aimed at bringing into the process of negotiation all the people and representative political formations of our country. We have to overcome the mistrust that exists on both sides and reinforce the understanding that the only victory we should all seek is the victory of the people as a whole and not the victory of one party over another. It is obvious that none of these processes can be easy. We are, however, inspired by the experience of the people of Namibia and our comrades in arms of SWAPO, who also overcame the divisions and the mistrust generated by the apartheid system, carried out a peaceful political process within a relatively short period of time, and are today a proud nation of independent people. We take this opportunity to salute the representatives of the Namibian people who are present in this hall and acknowledge the debt we owe. We owe them for the contribution they have made to our own liberation. We also salute the frontline states of Southern Africa and the rest of our continent. For their own enormous contribution to the struggle against apartheid, which has brought us to the point today when we can say that the victory of the struggle for a united, a democratic, and non-racial South Africa is within our grasp. Tribute is also due to the non-aligned countries and movement and the peoples of the rest of the world for their own sterling efforts in pursuit of the common cause. What we must once more urge is that all these forces should maintain their unity around the perspectives contained in the United Nations and Harare declarations on South Africa. How fast we progress towards liberation will depend on how successful we are in our efforts to sustain that united resolve. This is for us a moving moment because we know that as we stand here, we are among friends and people of conscience. We know this because we know what you did over the decades to secure my release and the release of other South African political prisoners from Pretoria's dungeons. We thank you most sincerely for this, especially because you have thus given us the opportunity to join hands with you in the search for a speedy solution to the enormous problems facing our country. Our region and continent and humanity as a whole. We know also that you harbor the hope that we will not relent or falter in the pursuit of that common vision, which will result in the transformation of South Africa into a country of democracy, justice, and peace. Standing before the nations of the world, we make that commitment, strengthened by the knowledge that you will fight on, side by side with us, until victory is achieved. We also take this opportunity to extend warm greetings to all others who fight for their liberation and their human rights, including the peoples of Palestine and Western Sahara. We commend their struggle to you, convinced that we are all moved by the fact that freedom is indivisible, convinced convinced that the denial of the rights of one diminish the freedom of others. We thank you for your kind invitation to us to address this august gathering and for the opportunity it has given us to pay homage to you all, to the Secretary General, the President of the General Assembly, excuse me, the Special Committee Against Apartheid, and the United Nations itself for the work that has been done to end the apartheid crime against humanity. The distance we still have to travel is not long. Let us travel it together. Let us, by our joint actions, vindicate the purposes for which this organization was established and create the situation where its charter and the Universal Declaration on Human Rights will become part of the body of law on which will be based the political and social order of a new South Africa. Our common victory is assured. Thank you.
This is Earthwatch, and you're listening to a special tribute to Nelson Mandela on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, or perhaps online, streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Next up, we hear Madiba, Nelson Mandela, addressing a capacity crowd in Oakland, California, on June 30th, 1990, following his prison release and preceding his 1994 groundbreaking election as President of South Africa.
Sisters and brothers, it is fascinating, it is historic, it is symbolic that this son of Africa comes at this moment to remind us of the unfinished business of ending apartheid in South Africa and racism in America, sexism in America, all forms of chauvinism in America. Let us welcome this extraordinary, beautiful black African man, one with the courage to turn to his enemy and say, forget the past, let us march to the future. Let's negotiate a new South Africa. Let us welcome this beautiful black man with unwavering integrity, incredible principle, unwavering courage, no fear. Let us welcome a man that makes us all feel somewhat taller, a hell of a lot stronger, and a whole lot more proud. Bay Area, let us welcome Nelson Mandela!
Comrades and friends, on my release from jail last February the 11th, we walked out of the prison gates to a tumultuous and joyous welcome. Our people, in their multitudes, had come from all corners of South Africa to receive us back into a world of struggle. The heaven rang with their chants of joy. 10 days ago, my delegation, my wife and I stepped on the soil of this United States. Once more, we were received with overwhelming attributes of friendship and solidarity. This experience has been repeated in every city we have visited. We have witnessed support for the fight against apartheid and for human liberty and peace in South Africa. It is clear, beyond any reasonable doubt, that the unbanning of our organization came as a result of the pressures exerted upon the apartheid regime by yourselves. By yourselves as part of the international community. And by the determined actions of our struggling people, you have inspired us beyond imagination. On behalf of the African National Congress and its entire membership, we thank you for your solidarity. It is a great honor for us because, in fact, it is a tribute to the fighting spirit of our people. We say it is a tribute to the fighting spirit of our people, who are also your people. We know that this rally was made possible by the unity in action of all sectors of this community. Today in South Africa, the same spirit has begun to break down the walls of apartheid. There are many obstacles ahead of us, both overt and covert. Many apartheid laws are still on the statute book. The freedom to conduct a political organization is still threatened by the state and right-wing vigilantes. Our schools are still segregated and inferior. Medical services are inadequate. Unemployment is high. Housing is scarce. And the masses of our people are still without land. It is our responsibility as the National Liberation Movement to take action for change. Our movement is now expected, after 3 decades of illegality, to operate efficiently. The task ahead is daunting, but our resolve is strong. In addition, our people are determined to fight for liberty until victory is achieved. The people's campaigns, carried out with amazing courage and great sacrifice, have pushed the government to concede the legal space for a widened political participation. We are at a crucial historical juncture. We cannot turn back. We shall not turn back. We need your support for this final stage. Now, more than ever, we call on you to redouble your efforts. We have spoken elsewhere of the inspired actions of great Americans, such as Martin Luther King Jr. Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, John Brown, and many others. Together, we must rekindle the spirit of strength and beauty and dispatch racism once and for all from human society. We are committed to the establishment of a united, non-racial, non-sexist, Democratic South Africa. We demand one person, one vote on a common non-racial voter's roll. Our people demand democracy. Our country, which continues to bleed and suffer pain, needs democracy. Our country stands on the threshold of fundamental change, but we still have a long road to travel before reaching our destination, freedom. As long as apartheid is in place, we appeal to you to maintain sanctions. That is a certain way to reach our objectives. We must keep the pressure on apartheid until victory is achieved. We salute the state of California for having such a powerful principled stance on divestment. We salute members of the International Longshoremen and Warehouseman Union, Local 10. Who refused to unload a South African cargo ship in 1984. In response to this demonstration, other workers, church people, community activists, and educators gathered each day at the docks to express their solidarity with the dock workers. They established themselves as the front line of the anti-apartheid movement in the Bay Area. And they laid the basis for the Bay Area Free South Africa movement. This movement has performed meritoriously in our support. And we were grieved to learn of the death of John George, the chairperson of the Bay Area Free South Africa movement. BAFSAM also acted in concert with the University of California, Berkeley Students Action for Divestment by marching onto campus in solidarity with the students. Finally, the regions of the University of California voted to divest. We also note that throughout, BAFSAM has emphasized the demand for our freedom and that of all South African political prisoners. We celebrate with you the imminent birth of a new South Africa, in which all shall be equal, irrespective of race, color, gender, or creed. We bring you greetings from Comrade Oliver Tambo, our president. I must add that since my arrival in this country, I have received several letters from organizations and individuals in the from the first American nation, the American Indians. In addition to these letters, I have received valuable, if not priceless, gifts from them. Just this morning, I received a number of gowns from them. They had wanted to rob me at the airport, but unfortunately, our convoy left the airport before arrangements could be made for them to perform the ceremony. When the robes came and their letter, I was already here. I then requested the mayor to allow me to meet this delegation, which is led by Mr. or Miss Cooper. Unfortunately, we were unable to contact them despite the diligent inquiry by the mayor. These letters, which I have received, describes the conditions of the American Indians here. And I can assure you that they have left me very disturbed. If I had the time, I would have visited their areas, spoken to their leaders and their organizations, and got from them an authoritative picture of the difficulties under which they live. But unfortunately, my schedule is very tight, and I cannot carry out this wish. But I can assure the leaders of the Indian community that I will return in October. With the permission of my organization, which I am sure I will get, I will visit the Indian areas in this country and get a briefing from the Indian community. We will exchange views as to what I could do to help them in their struggle. In the meantime, I want to tell you that Oaklands is the last city that I am visiting in the course of my tour. Let me assure you that despite my 71 years, at the end of this visit, I feel like a young man of 35. I feel like an old battery that has been recharged. And if I feel so young, if I feel like an old battery that has been recharged, It is the people of the United States of America that are responsible for this. It is you, the people of Oakland, the people of the Bay Area, who have given me and my delegation strength and hope to go back and continue the struggle. You must remember that you are our blood brothers and sisters. You are our comrades in the struggle. Remember that we respect you, we admire you, and above all, we love you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. I'm Robert Knight. And finally, in today's celebration of Nelson Mandela's life, we hear Archbishop Desmond Tutu addressing an African-American church and recalling his own adventures with Madiba Nelson Mandela.
I bring greetings to you from your sisters and brothers in South Africa. When I was last here, we were living in hope. And now, dear friends, we are seeing a veritable miracle unfold before our very eyes. We're seeing a dream come true. Someone back home said to me, he said to his wife, "Darling, please don't wake me. I love this dream." It's an incredible thing, for we are seeing a nation come to birth. We have notching up a spectacular victory over evil, injustice, and oppression. And you, friends, all of you, under George's scintillating and inspiring leadership, with Mary and all of you here, are a very, very substantial part of that victory. We would not be where we are without your incredible support, your love, your prayers, your caring, doing things sometimes that were unpopular, such as supporting our campaign for the imposition of sanctions. And so, isn't it wonderful to be able to come and to say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, all of you beautiful people. Thank you, thank you. You are just tremendous how you could have learned our anthems so beautifully and to sing them so wonderfully. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, you know, I always say, can you join me in clapping you? I think a standing ovation to all of you, to all the people of this incredible country who have brought us to the point that we have reached. How about doing that? Come on, come on! Please, we mustn't forget that it is a great victory. We mustn't forget the viciousness that was apartheid. Because only just a short 4 or 5 years ago, we could not walk on God's beaches because they were segregated beaches. And when we were protesting against that foul law, the police were ready then, as they said, to use even live ammunition to get us to move away. To use live ammunition to support, defend something so utterly indefensible. We mustn't forget that. So we were in real trouble. I don't know whether you know the story of this guy who was going to make his first parachute jump.
And they told him, there are two togs here. You pull on the one, and the parachute will open. If it doesn't open, don't worry, you've got a second. And you probably won't ever need to use it. But if you have to use it, it's certain the parachute will open. And so this guy came and he made his jump and he pulled on the one toggle. Nothing happened. And he was hurtling down to the ground. And he tried on the second and nothing happened. And as he was about to hit the ground, somebody went past him in the opposite direction. And he said, "Help! Do you know anything about parachutes?" And this other one said, "No! Do you know anything about pressure cookers?" Well, we were in real trouble. And you prayed us out of that trouble. You supported us out of that trouble. You remember that lovely story with Elisha, the prophet, surrounded by the armies of the king, and his servant, totally apprehensive, is frightened. And Elisha says to God, "Open his eyes so that he may see." And God opens the servant's eyes. And when he sees God's host surrounding them, and he learns, therefore, that those for us are many, many times more than those against us. And we experience that. In the dark days of apartheid, you were their friends. And it is so wonderfully appropriate that we can be here to celebrate with you. The psalmist somewhere says, as he exults over God, "You are a God who works wonders. You are a God who works miracles." Now, we in South Africa can say amen to that. Because as we were approaching this epoch-making election, we were gritting our teeth, fearful of the violence that was going to be happening because a major political party, the Inkatha Freedom Party, led by Chief Buthelezi, had said it was boycotting the elections. And you know the violence and the death that had already resulted because of the rivalry between this Inkatha party and the ANC. And then, this God who works miracles, this wonder-working God, did his stuff. And out of the blue, at the proverbial 11th hour, the Inkatha Freedom Party said we were going to participate in the elections. And almost as if someone was turning on or turning off the violence reduced quite dramatically. And then the election happened. And we were still scared that people would be intimidated. There were the bomb blasts just before. But instead, people poured out in their millions. And maybe it was just as well we aren't as efficient as you. Because they then had to stand in those long lines for hours on end. John, my media secretary, says there is a new status symbol in South Africa. People say, "Oh, you know, I stood for 2 hours before I could vote." And somebody says, "Oh, that's nothing. I stood there for 5 hours, and somebody else does something else. But it was actually an incredible thing, because South Africans suddenly discovered one another. As they stood in those queues, sharing food, talking to one another, black and white, suddenly made a profound scientific discovery. They discovered that they were South Africans together. We had been trying to tell them. They have a character in South Africa called Van der Merwe. He came out to the United States with, because it's the new South Africa, he came with a friend, a Dlanga Mandla, black friend. They got into trouble. I think they maybe committed murder, I don't know. They were sentenced to death, but they were given a choice. You could choose the rope or choose the electric chair. And Van der Merwe went in first and chose the electric chair. For some odd reason, having thrown the switch, nothing happened. 3 times, nothing happened. And they said, well, no, Van der Merwe, we don't know what's happened, but I think we're going to give you a reprieve. And so he got out. And his friend, the black South African, was next in the queue. And Van der Merwe said, the damn thing doesn't work. Choose the rope. An election for you normally would be a secular event, a political event. It turned out for us to be a spiritual event. It became a religious mountaintop transfiguration experience. South Africans walked into the polling booth, one kind of person, and emerged on the other side, a different kind of person. They walked in carrying, if they were white, a heavy burden of guilt, and they emerged on the other side. They were surprised. This huge weight of guilt had been lifted. They were free. And black people walked in and emerged on the other side and suddenly discovered that the dignity that had been denied them, that had been trodden underfoot for so long, had been restored. You know, God 2,000 years ago made a cross on a ballot box, choosing to give us Jesus. This Jesus who then, in this act of the cross, produced a new people. Through this, the cross that God made, reconciliation was effected. And we, on the 27th of April, made our cross and discovered that this cross had this incredible capacity to make us new people. That this cross helped to make us reconciled to one another. And at the end of this process, incredibly, there was no gloating. No, I mean, the ANC didn't say we had won this enormous victory. Incredible. I don't know why it didn't happen, except that you were praying. George sent us a message and said, we're praying here in All Saints for your election. And you prayed. And God heard. And this miracle working God did his stuff again. And now we have a government of national unity. Mr. de Klerk, who must, for always be commended for the courage he had shown in February 1990, has shown a remarkable graciousness in taking not just second fiddle, he is now third fiddle. Now that is actually something quite remarkable. But then you see, I'm not boasting. We are remarkable people in South Africa. We have a government that is made up of nearly all the parties. And so we don't have, at least we hope they're not going to be a confrontational way of working. They are accommodating one another. Mandela was elected president unopposed. Then they elected the first woman to be Speaker of Parliament unopposed, but a member of the ANC. Then they elected the deputy speaker from the Nationalist Party, unopposed. And then the Senate, they elected a nationalist to be president when the ANC had an overwhelming majority there. But they chose to have a president who was a nationalist, and then the deputy also elected unopposed. And we are saying, these people want to be healed. These people have all been traumatized by apartheid. And you, friends, have still got an important role to play. Pray us into healing, into becoming truly one. We now have a new flag. And we are all suddenly so patriotic. We love our flag. We have, in fact, now 3 national anthems. I sang the Afrikaans one for the very first time in my life. But I sang it, and it seemed so right to sing it. So we sing Nkosi Sikelele, Morena Buluka Sechaba, the one that you sang so beautifully, and the Afrikaans one. I wept at 2 points. When they elected Mandela president, and then at the inauguration, when the flypast happened, for some extraordinary reason, almost all of us, certainly in the black community, suddenly looked up at these machines that used to be killing machines for us. Machines that we used to shake our clenched fist at. When they went past to salute Mandela as the new commander-in-chief, almost as if somebody touched a button which affected all of us, we said, hey, these are now ours. We are one people of different cultures and races, of different faiths, but we are now one people. And we're going to make it. We're going to make it. You know why? Because God wants us to succeed. Now, I'm not saying this because I have a hotline to heaven. It is for one very important reason. The world is looking on and is sickened by the ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. The world is looking on and it is appalled by the disintegration of the former Soviet Union. The world is looking on and is filled with revulsion at the carnage in Rwanda. In many places, things are falling apart. For some extraordinary reason. Although our country was one that was tailor-made for alienation and breaking apart. They were coming together. And God says, I want you to succeed. I want you to succeed so that you can be a paradigm for the world. I want the world to see, yes, it is possible for different people to become one people. And so we say, hey, we are free, all of us, black and white together, the rainbow people of God. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Archbishop Desmond Tutu recalling Nelson Mandela on the 5th of June, 1994. And that concludes today's Earthwatch tribute to Madiba Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm.
a bird. We have all seen him standing amidst the surprise. Sometimes a man smiles, I often wonder. You can tell he's a thinker by the faraway look in his eyes. The faraway look in his eyes. A pity for his thoughts could make him richer. His eyes could see what other eyes could not. What is the power?
We welcome your comments with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's R-K-N-I-G-H-T @wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York. Up next, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, sadly, another tribute program. 2 weeks ago, Jack Vance, still to come, Ian Banks. This morning, Richard Matheson. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, writer and critic for Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com. And if all goes as planned, this is the third review you're hearing from me this morning. Collect them all.
And the plans,
we're going
Dan.
To be talking about World War Z, so let's just get a point of terminology straight right off. When I'm talking about revivified corpses with an instinctive reflexive hunger for the living, I'm going to use the term zombie. There are other terms for them. Some would argue more accurate terms, the Walking Dead, walkers, biters, rotters, snappers, slippers, Denny's customers. I'm sticking with zombies, imprecision be damned, both because it seems to be the most widely comprehended term and also because it's the one I automatically go for. So on to the film. And let me say this, it isn't that World War Z is definitive proof that a film about a zombie outbreak, a phenomenon we always presume is taking place on a global scale, can't be portrayed on that global scale. It does demonstrate that if you're going to try for that, it's not a simple matter of boosting the budget and laying in the CG swarms of ambulatory corpses. The reasons why, we'll get to in a sec. The story at base is pretty simple. The world is succumbing to a zombie plague. Infected people are being overcome with an irrepressible drive to bite the living, who after 12 seconds or so, turn themselves. It's a fast-spreading thing, governments are toppling, society is crumbling, and Brad Pitt plays a former UN troubleshooter sent on a worldwide search for Patient Zero, who it is hoped will hold the key to the cure. For the purposes of the film, worldwide search means South Korea, Israel, and Wales, and the film also tries to trump up some drama with Pitt being torn between his responsibility to his family and his duty as apparently the only man on Earth who can pull off this mission, but it doesn't really amount to much. There is an opportunity here. As I pointed out before, zombie outbreak films don't usually get portrayed on the world stage, so this is an opportunity to see what that would be like. And there's certainly potential in both drama and action in Brad Pitt's visit to an embattled Korean military station, to a fortified Jerusalem, and to a World Health Organization research center in Cardiff. Unfortunately, director Mark Forster doesn't take advantage of the opportunities given him. Shots of attacking zombie hordes that should be dazzling and disturbing are instead confusing and unimpressive. Action sequences too often rely on shaky cam to trump up excitement, which just makes them look lousy, especially in 3D, and the plotting is so heavily dependent on contrivances that Brad Pitt's character comes off less as resilient and resourceful, and more as the luckiest son of a gun on Earth. The grandest irony is that World War Z's final act is based around the film's characters sneaking into a zombie-infested laboratory to retrieve some crucial supplies. And after woefully flawed attempts at epic scale, the film finally finds its footing in a sequence that's intimate, suspenseful, narrows its stakes to ones that matter for the characters on screen, and finally finally gets us up close and personal with the zombies, who are actually quite nicely conceived combinations of creepy makeup and spastic, reflexive choreography. Here's the major pitfall of treating a zombie outbreak tale from a worldwide perspective. As interesting as is the idea of seeing legions of the Walking Dead flooding the globe, the true power of the zombie genre is the personal one, of placing yourself in the position of looking into the eyes of something both other and not, of battling to push aside every empathetic instinct you have to recognize something that is pure, instinctive hunger. That's something that no swooping CG-enhanced crowd shot can capture. As ambitious as it may be, World War Z discovers that lesson too late and fails because of it. I'm Dan Person. See my daily Here's What's Going On video news updates over at cfqonline.com.
And thank you, Dan. We have two yet unplayed reviews from Dan, but that one was the most au courant, and I thought we would start with that. We also have Man of Steel, but we talked about that. He didn't record that one for me, did he, as a matter of fact? Because he was here live last week, if you were listening. And if you weren't, well, why not? Anyhow, we have, the Will Smith movie and others. But we have, after all of the 5 weeks of not being on the air for the thon, and this problem and that problem and so on and so forth. Pardon me, by the way, while I cue something up. I have any number of interviews. Yes, the second one.
I prefer the first one.
Yeah, okay, fine. Do you think they spell the number?
I don't know. I got a great version of it, but it's probably not here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, let's just see. Here's the artist, okay. So let's see. Here's the album. Why don't they have... There it is.
Okay.
There it is. And it's not a live version. We haven't said a thing.
Song is great too.
Yeah, they're both good. Well, you know, depending on how.
The first one I told you.
But that's 10 minutes long. The story, the reason I'm not doing Duel is because Duel would take about 75 minutes.
Wow.
I'm already too late on it.
Okay, well, you better get cracking.
Yeah, well, this one's about 45 minutes. I have recorded interviews with Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, with Moira Crone, who is just a brilliant, brilliant writer, Tom Doyle, whose first collection of short stories is out, and he made a topical, at the time, announcement about a movie series. I'm going to be recording an interview with Kate Elliott next Tuesday. I forgot to bring information about next Tuesday, but I can tell you all about it off the top of my head. But I'll do that in just a moment. But, I mean, it's absolutely horrible and miserable what's going on. In fact, I got an email from Andrew Porter. Let's see if I can... I have a device here. My little phone here.